and KFCF in Fresno at 88.1. The time is 6 p.m. Here's the KPFA Evening News.
Good evening. It's Monday, September 15th, the worst day on Wall Street since the September 11th attacks, as the Dow Jones drops more than 500 points. Investors react to the bankruptcy declaration by the Lehman Brothers Investment Bank, the biggest in U.S. history, the purchase of a second bank, Merrill Lynch, by the Bank of America at half price, and as American Insurance Group, the world's largest insurer, fights for its survival. State lawmakers to vote on a compromise to end California's longest ever budget stalemate. The Senate and Assembly expected to vote tonight to approve a patchwork proposal that closes a $15 billion deficit without borrowing or new taxes. It is a spending plan that will make next year's budget problem even worse. Thousands of victims of Hurricane Ike settle in at shelters for what could be weeks, and others wait in long lines for food, water, ice, and gasoline. Deaths are relatively low, 37 in Texas and 8 in other states. An estimated 2.2 million people are without power in Texas alone. Another U.S. incursion into Pakistan to get at Taliban sanctuaries along the Afghan border. But witnesses say Pakistani forces fire warning shots at American helicopter gunships to drive them off. Pakistani Army Corps commanders reportedly decided over the weekend to engage U.S. forces unilaterally invading their territory. South American presidents hold an emergency meeting in Chile, hoping to prevent a political collapse in Bolivia, where the left-wing government of Evo Morales plans to charge a rebellious eastern governor with genocide for allegedly ordering the machine gunning of peasants. And Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe cedes some power for the first time in 28 years as he signs a power-sharing agreement with the opposition. This is the KPFA Evening News with John Hamilton. I'm Mark Miracle. The upheaval in the American financial system sent shockwaves through the stock market today, producing the worst day on Wall Street in 7 years, as investors digested the failure of one of its most venerable banks and wondered which domino would be next to fall. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 500 points, more than 4%, its steepest point drop since the day the stock market reopened after the September 11th, 2001 attacks. About $700 billion evaporated from retirement plans, government pension funds, and other investment portfolios. The carnage capped a tumultuous 24 hours that redrew U.S. finance, Lehman Brothers, an investment bank that predates the Civil War and weathered the Great Depression, filed the largest bankruptcy in American history. A second storied bank, Merrill Lynch, fled into the arms of the Bank of America. It was by far the most stomach-churning single day since a financial crisis began to bubble up from billions of dollars in rotten mortgage loans that have crippled the balance sheets of one bank after another and landed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac under the control of the federal government. And the fallout is far from over. American Insurance Group, the world's largest insurer, is fighting for its very survival. New York Governor David Paterson moved to allow the company to tap one of its subsidiaries for an emergency loan to stay above water. Tanya Snyder reports.
Lehman Brothers had nowhere left to go but down. Officials spent the weekend frantically negotiating for a second chance, but buyers weren't biting, and the federal government said no to a bailout. The fourth largest investment firm in the country, Lehman Brothers is the biggest financial company to go into bankruptcy. By refusing to spend taxpayer money to save the 158-year-old company, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department drew a line in the sand. They bailed out Bear Stearns in March, and they bailed out mortgage brokers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac just last week. But they're banking on the fact that the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy won't spell disaster for the global economy. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson explained how he sees the root of the problem.
When we look at our financial institutions, the root of the problem lies in this housing correction. And until we stem the housing correction, until the biggest part of that is behind us and we have more stability in housing prices, we're going to continue to have turmoil in the financial markets.
While the government decided not to step in, 10 banks have pitched in $7 billion each to create a fund to rescue troubled financial companies and restore stability. Lehman Brothers officials say they will take steps to keep their operations running and continue paying their 24,000 employees, though the future is uncertain. Some employees are reportedly already packing up their desks. Democratic Senator Carl Levin didn't advocate a bailout, but he did say the government wasn't in a strong place to respond to weakened financial markets.
I think chickens are coming home to roost with the push economic policies. You do need an aggressive government when you're in a decline and a recession. And we're in a much weaker position to do what we need to do, whatever we decide that is, because of the huge deficits.
At the same time as the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, Bank of America announced it was acquiring Merrill Lynch for $29 a share at a time when the shares were valued at $17. Merrill Lynch was under pressure to find a merger partner in short order, as consistent losses, due in part to the subprime mortgage crisis, were expected to cause a sharp decline in share price. Ken Lewis, CEO and president of Bank of America, played down the desperate last-minute nature of the deal, saying it had always been on the horizon. The right moment just hadn't come along until now.
This is the strategic deal of a lifetime.
The buyout gives the nation's biggest consumer bank control over the nation's biggest brokerage operation. American International Group, the world's largest insurer, is looking to restructure, and a major announcement is expected soon. The company could dispose of assets like its domestic automotive business or its aircraft leasing business. Many other financial firms and banks could also see losses due to a drop in consumer confidence, dropping prices after the liquidation of Lehman Brothers assets, or countless other potential causes in a wobbly market. Only Treasury bond sales are booming as investors rush to safe, government-backed investments in a time of uncertainty. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Nomi Prinz is a former managing director at Goldman Sachs. She's now a senior fellow at the Public Policy Center, Demos. She spoke with reporter Leanne Caldwell about the financial crisis.
The main problem that we have here is that Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch can't pay the money they owe to run their businesses. They just simply do not have enough capital to exist. Lehman had to declare bankruptcy because it couldn't get the capital it needed to keep going. And Merrill Lynch, facing that potential problem, needed a Hail Mary pass from the financial industry, and that is, at the moment, Bank of America.
They didn't have enough capital, these two major companies. How come?
It's insane. The reality is these companies, as many other Wall Street companies, have been operating in the last several years in this zone of speculation where the housing market was one sort of place in which to speculate, and they just borrowed and sold and borrowed and sold and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed to get themselves to be in a position where they speculatively thought they could make tremendous amounts of money, but they just didn't have enough left when things started falling apart to keep themselves going.
I want to ask you about deregulation. In 1999, deregulation allowed one company to perform the tasks of both consumer bank and investment bank. Bank of America, a consumer bank, bought one of the largest investment firms, Merrill Lynch. Is this continuing further along the path of deregulation, and what kind of impact could it have?
It is absolutely continuing along the path of deregulation in 1999, where the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, which had separated commercial banking from speculative investment banking, was first enacted. And in that year, Citigroup merged with Salomon Brothers. Later, J.P. Morgan merged with Chase, which was a commercial bank. And now we have Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. And it's very, very dangerous. It's the same path, and it is the long path. Because the Federal Reserve, which backs these banks, as it did Sunday night, can say to a Lehman Brothers, which is just an investment bank, you know, no, you're not getting bailout from us. You know, no, go do what you need to do. Declare bankruptcy. We're not going to help you. They can't do that with the Bank of America. Bank of America is on the hook to too many millions of actual citizen, ordinary people, customers. So it's continuation of deregulation, and it's also continuing to destabilize the financial industry and therefore the general economy.
What should be done to help the average person?
Well, there have been housing bills to talk about helping some of those facing foreclosure through their banks. But the fact is, if their banks and their lenders are going under or having problems with their own capital, it makes it harder for citizens to renegotiate, even with, you know, some lukewarm congressional backing, their own personal loans. But in order to really help citizens, the government seriously has to look at making the banking system safer and less risky for those ordinary citizens.
This isn't the first. It might not be the last. What's your assessment, and what can we see from here on out?
JPMorgan Chase will have capital problems beyond once it gets through sorting what Bear Stearns' real risks were. And Bank of America is going to have to figure out what Merrill Lynch actually had on its book. These lightning-quick mergers in this environment really are dangerous for the balance sheet of any financial institution because they don't have time to figure out what their risks really are. And that means that the system itself will only keep seeing a pouring out of assets that have no value, which will decrease everyone else's assets, which will decrease their capital bases, which will keep the industry for the time being in a really perilous state.
Nomi Prinz, former managing director at Goldman Sachs, now a senior fellow at the Public Policy Center, Demos. She spoke with reporter Leanne Caldwell.
Hewlett-Packard says it plans to slash nearly 8% of its workforce over the next 3 years as it combines operations with Electronic Data Systems, the Texas-based technology services company it recently acquired. Hewlett-Packard said today most of the 24,600 job cuts will come from within Electronic Data Systems ranks. Nearly half will hit jobs in the U.S. Hewlett-Packard had not previously detailed how many employees of the combined company would lose their jobs. Before the acquisition, the company had 178,000 people, and Electronic Data Systems had 142,000, for a total of 320,000. The Palo Alto, California-based Hewlett-Packard expects the cuts to save nearly $2 billion a year. Last month, the company reported third-quarter profits of $2.2 billion. That's up from $1.9 billion in profit a year earlier.
A budget agreement is headed for a vote in the state legislature. Legislative leaders hammered out an agreement reportedly without much input from Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The agreement breaks an 11-week stalemate, giving the minority Republicans much of what they had demanded to win their votes. Passing a budget takes a two-thirds majority. At this time, it's far from clear how the final vote will turn out. Christopher Martinez reports.
Legislative leaders have reached agreement on a state budget that hands Republicans a victory in their fight against tax increases. But some tax experts are blasting the agreement as a huge corporate giveaway that creates new tax loopholes while cutting education and health and welfare programs. The budget closes a $15.2 billion gap with a combination of spending cuts and accounting maneuvers. Sherry Bevitz-Jeffy is with the School of Policy, Planning and Development at the University of Southern California.
The winners are the two Republican legislative caucuses. They didn't so much as blink.
Republicans did give up some of the deep cuts in services they had wanted, such as rollbacks in Medi-Cal eligibility and elimination of some Medi-Cal services. The agreement also avoids premium increases for some health programs and increases in paperwork for children and poor families on health programs. But there are still some cuts to health and welfare programs, and schools will get about $3 billion less than they need to keep up current programs. As for revenues, Republicans pretty much got their way. Democratic lawmakers had wanted to include more than $9 billion in tax increases on corporations and wealthy Californians. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had proposed $5 billion in the form of a temporary sales tax increase, but neither is in the budget agreement. Instead, the budget makes accounting changes to accelerate when revenues are counted. Jane Ross is with the nonpartisan California Budget Project. She says it's like a no-interest loan from taxpayers to the state.
So it's basically, it's a classic accounting gimmick, and if we understand how the proposal would work, it would be a permanent change in California's accounting practices that will simply move money from one fiscal year into the prior fiscal year. Again, no new money, simply changing how we account for the same tax dollars.
The budget agreement also relies on changes to corporate taxes, letting some corporations trade tax credits and changing the way they get refunds for losses. Lenny Goldberg is with the California Tax Reform Association.
This is worse. This isn't even moving revenues around. This is making the problem at least $1 billion worse in the future. This is cutting in exchange for short-term borrowing and no real revenues. This ends up with huge losses in the corporation tax in the future. So this is a big tax cut for multinational corporations without getting any real revenue on the table.
Lawmakers were scheduled to vote on the budget late Monday afternoon, but by news time they were still meeting in caucuses. If the budget does pass, lawmakers can say they closed the budget gap, but the underlying budget problems will be back with a vengeance in the next budget year. On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Nursing home workers at Sunnyside Convalescent Hospital in Fresno staged a one-day strike today. The caregivers said they were forced to walk out because for the past 4 weeks they have been given incomplete paychecks or no checks at all. On September 6th, management sent out a letter saying the workers would not be paid until the state budget crisis is resolved. SEIU United Healthcare Workers West also charges that Sunnyside owner Michael Fellin has not maintained adequate medical supplies, putting care for the seniors at risk. Juanita Montoya is a certified nursing assistant who has worked at Sunnyside for 25 years.
I like to say this to Michael Fellin. Enough is enough. Pay what you owe us and quit stalling. We are committed to provide best care for our residents, and we demand respect and justice. And if you are not able to provide that, you should find another business.
Of the 50 or so nursing homes represented by United Healthcare West in the Central Valley, Fresno's Sunnyside is the only one to withhold workers' pay. Since October of last year, the union has been negotiating with management for a new contract that raises standards for patient care and workforce retention. The previous contract expired in November.
The rate at which inmates are dying in California prisons is dropping, a possible result of a federal takeover of the medical system. The annual rate dropped from nearly 300 deaths per 100,000 prisoners in early 2006 to about 200 deaths per 100,000 in mid-2008. The federal court-appointed receiver who oversees the prison medical system attributes the decline to the hiring of hundreds of doctors and nurses. The death rate was noted in a quarterly report sent today from receiver Clark Kelso to a federal judge in San Francisco. The judge appointed a receiver to take over medical care after finding in 2005 that too many inmates were dying of malpractice or neglect.
Thousands of victims of Hurricane Ike settled in at shelters for what could be weeks, and others waited wearily in line for food, water, ice, and gasoline today, as it became increasingly clear the disaster along the Texas coast would be measured not by its death toll, but by the misery it spread. Almost 3 days after the storm steamrolled the coast, the extent of the damage was still coming into focus, with rescue teams finally reaching some of the hardest hit and most inaccessible places, including Bolivar Peninsula, a resort on Galveston Bay where entire neighborhoods were obliterated. While the number of confirmed deaths was still remarkably low at 37 in Texas and 8 in other states, the distress was considerable. Max Radcliffe reports.
Rescuers scoured Texas's Bolivar Peninsula today in search of survivors in the wake of Hurricane Ike. What they found was the town of Gilchrist virtually wiped out, massive flooding in Orange and Port Arthur, and utter devastation in the island resort town of Galveston, where 4 are confirmed dead. What rescuers did not find today was people. Tens of thousands of residents of southeast Texas have made the journey inland in search of shelter. 2,000 more were rescued within 48 hours of Hurricane Ike's landfall. But Texas Governor Rick Perry says the search is still on.
Search and rescue continues to go forward. That's obviously our number one priority. But at the same time, there's some parallel efforts going to push food, ice, water into Houston and Orange County and Beaumont, those other areas that were hit very hard.
Officials from the coastal region say it could be weeks before residents can return to their homes. Governor Perry is urging Houston's evacuees to resist the temptation to return home.
The last thing they need to do is to leave the comfort or the relative comfort of where they are and go back into the city of Houston. Still about 2.5 million people without power, and hopefully we can get that back up as soon as possible.
But many more remain in Houston, many of them unable to evacuate for lack of transportation. Ada Edwards is a special assistant to the mayor of Houston.
In Houston, we don't have the kind of devastation that you saw in New Orleans. But in some of our communities that have been historically underserved, when this type of event happens, it's kind of like devastating. We learned a lot of lessons here in Houston with Katrina and Rita. But in one area that I used to be the council person for, 60% of those people that live in that area, their primary transportation is public transportation. So when you're asking people to go to points of distribution to pick up supplies, there's no way for them to get there.
Ms. Edwards said that efforts are underway to bring supplies to local drop-off points around the city for residents who cannot access the major relief distribution centers. It is the efforts of people in their own communities, she says, that have been most effective.
The great thing about this whole tragedy, if there can be a great thing, is the human spirit of the people of Houston. And even with our poorest and people who have been disenfranchised, they still have a spirit of saying, you know, we can do this if we work together. And so I think that's our biggest ally right now, is the spirit and the determination of our community and our people.
For KPFA News, I'm Max Radcliffe.
From Houston, Rachel Clark filed this report on how that city's homeless population weathered the storm.
I had to spend the night up under the Hyatt Hotel parking garage. They tried to kick me out.
James Taylor is a homeless Houston resident who didn't have many choices when seeking shelter from Hurricane Ike.
I said, forget that, man, because at the time the wind was blowing sideways. So I sat in the west corner of the Hyatt Hotel and I actually saw the whole thing.
Advocates for the poor and homeless tried to warn people in advance of the storm. Rhonda Robinson's executive director of Covenant House, one of many Houston nonprofit organizations working with homeless populations.
When my outreach team goes out, one of the parts that we do a lot is to talk to especially homeless young people about what's happening. Are you prepared? Do you need a place to go? If so, then we need you to start doing some things like this. They didn't spend the night on the street. They came in to us. And because we were still open, we were able to provide them, we call them sleepovers. They just slept over.
James Taylor said he knew of the storm, but waited too long to find refuge.
The police officer, he told me when I was walking my way toward, so I started to walk toward Savage Norman, but it got a little bit too windy. So I turned back and I said, well, I gotta find some spot. So I said, hey, look, man, I'm gonna go in this garage.
Another issue confronting the city was how to contact the chronically homeless. Rhonda Robinson says the chronically homeless generally do not frequent shelters where such information is given.
I think, you know, again, the homeless population is one that is vulnerable. And as always, I don't know if anybody has a really true count, you know. And I just pray all the time those people that are chronically homeless that may not come out, that hopefully we had a plan.
Ernest Levy is another homeless resident who is trapped in the city center. He said he did not know about Hurricane Ike closing in on Texas.
Do you know that wind and that rain and all that was whipping, you know, on my face, you know, getting people soaking wet? And we were sitting up in there and staying out there because, honey, this storm will take you out there in the sea and drown you out there.
So what was the city's plan for people like Ernest? One homeless person who preferred not to give his name says the city's idea of safe place is not the answer.
Oh, yeah, they got folks on the streets. They did sweeps all night. They were throwing people out at my college jail.
When Mayor White said, well, you know, I saw his press conference, you know, and they were asking him about that. He said, well, we did sweeps all night. We put him in a safe place. Yeah, I know where your safe place is all too well. You know, they take him out to my tower, or they take him downtown. But, you know, he says, I don't really want to go into detail about it. You know, our next question?
No city official was available to comment regarding the use of jails as shelters of last resort for homeless trapped in the streets during Ike. Reporting from Houston, I'm Rachel Clark in collaboration with Katie Heim, Free Speech Radio News.
Pakistani troops backed by helicopter gunships and fighter jets killed 24 militants today, an official said, in an operation praised by U.S. commanders worried about Taliban sanctuaries near the Afghan border. The Pakistani operation comes amid tension with the U.S. over whether the Muslim nation is doing enough to combat insurgents in its wild border region. Named as a possible hideout for al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, and whether the U.S. should pursue unilateral strikes there. Today, residents and intelligence officials claimed Pakistani troops fired warning shots after suspected American helicopters landed near their positions in another militant stronghold further south. The U.S. military in Afghanistan denied involvement. Mazrur Hussein reports from Karachi.
Three Chinook helicopters carrying some 30 well-armed American troops stationed in the U.S.-occupied Afghanistan crossed over into Pakistani-administered tribal areas early Monday morning. However, they flew back when the Pakistan Army opened a barrage of anti-aircraft fire. Local journalists say the Pakistan Army has the support of local tribesmen. Journalists say the American helicopters were followed by a unit of armored personnel carriers on the ground. The decision to engage American troops entering Pakistani territory was taken in an emergency meeting of Pakistan Army's core commanders over the weekend. All commanders agreed to engage the U.S. troops if they entered Pakistani territory, and such orders were passed on to field commanders. The meeting was called in response to a report in the Daily Jung suggesting that under the U.S.-India nuclear cooperation plan, the Pentagon threatened to deploy 100,000 Indian troops along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. A drone attack was repelled Sunday when Pakistan Air Force jet fighters scrambled from the nearby Kamra Air Base. Journalists in the tribal area fear the U.S. may launch a major attack on Pakistan to clear the bad publicity it received in the two failed attempts. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Karachi.
South American presidents met urgently today in Santiago, Chile, hoping to prevent a political collapse in Bolivia, where the government plans to charge a rebellious eastern governor with genocide for allegedly ordering the machine gunning of peasants. Bolivia's leftist president Evo Morales arrived at the hastily called summit, having effectively lost control of half of his country. Anti-Morales protesters have blocked highways, taken over national government offices, closed border crossings, and sabotaged pipelines, briefly forcing a cutoff of nearly half of Bolivia's natural gas exports to Brazil. The most serious challenge yet to Morales' presidency is being spurred by governors of Bolivia's autonomy-seeking lowland provinces, home to the nation's energy deposits and best farmland. The governors want a larger share of the nation's gas profits and are demanding that Morales cancel the centerpiece of his 3-year tenure, a planned referendum on a new constitution that would give Bolivia's long-suppressed indigenous majority more power, let Morales run for a consecutive second term, and transfer fallow terrain to landless peasants. Morales has the support of most Bolivians. Voters ratified his presidency by an impressive 67% in an August 10th recall referendum, a 13% jump over what the native Aymara and former Cocoa Growers Union leader won in the December 2005 presidential elections. But the same referendum also gave several of the rebellious governors renewed support in their provinces, where Morales' authority is tenuous at best. Bolivia's chief prosecutor said he would charge Governor Leopoldo Fernandez and other top officials in Pando, the jungle province on the Brazilian border where 30 people were killed in political violence last week, with genocide for provoking a bloody massacre. Morales says thugs used machine guns against his supporters in an ambush last Thursday, prompting him to declare martial law in Pando. But Governor Fernandez remains defiant, saying the deaths came not in an ambush, but in an armed clash, that Morales is persecuting him politically, and that he will stay put in Pando's capital. Many of the anti-Morales blockades were dismantled over the weekend as a goodwill gesture, as both sides sought to establish ground rules for negotiations. And while Bolivia was generally quiet today, more than 1,000 government supporters marched on the U.S. Embassy in the capital of La Paz, burning an American flag and effigies of opposition governors. Some 5,000 Bolivian migrants marched in Buenos Aires as well, in support of the Morales government. Morales expelled Washington's ambassador, accusing him of encouraging the unrest. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez expelled his country's U.S. ambassador last week in solidarity with Morales, and the U.S. responded in kind. Arriving in Chile today, Chavez said a conspiracy directed by the U.S. empire was at work in Bolivia. He compared it to the 1973 coup supported by the CIA, which toppled Chile's President Salvador Allende.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe ceded some power today for the first time in 28 years by signing a power-sharing deal with opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. The deal comes amid questions on how the fierce enemies will work together to fix the collapsing economy. Under the power-sharing agreement, Mugabe will serve as president, Tsvangirai as prime minister. Mugabe will oversee Zimbabwe's army, while Tsvangirai will determine domestic policy and control the same police forces that once beat and brutalized him and his supporters. Tsvangirai welcomed the deal at a formal ceremony in the capital of Harare.
I have signed this agreement because I believe it represents the best opportunity for us to build a peaceful, prosperous, democratic Zimbabwe.
The agreement followed weeks of tense negotiations to end a political crisis that began in June after Mugabe claimed victory in an uncontested election. That election was to have been a runoff, but Tsvangirai backed out after widespread political violence targeted his party and supporters. At today's signing ceremony, Mugabe accused the United States and Britain of seeking regime change in Zimbabwe and warned against interference.
We'll cooperate with those who are well disposed towards us, but we must resist those who want to impose their own will on us.
Mugabe, Tsvangirai, and Arthur Mutambara, leader of a faction that broke away from Tsvangirai's party, all pledged to make the deal work. But long simmering and bitter differences, as well as the nation's economic collapse, have put the deal under intense pressure. It has already been criticized privately by some opposition leaders, who are unhappy that it leaves Mugabe as president and head of the government. They fear Mugabe will exploit that, especially by playing on tensions between the two opposition groups. 9 African leaders, including mediator President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, witnessed the signing in a show of commitment to the deal, which the African Union is underwriting.
Nigerian militants today attacked a Shell-operated oil facility, killing a guard and forcing the evacuation of nearly 100 staff in a third day of fighting with security forces. Security sources said the 3 days of clashes were the heaviest between the two sides since the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, launched a campaign of violence in early 2006, saying it wanted more local control of the impoverished region's oil wealth. MEND declared an oil war yesterday and warned all oil workers to leave the Delta immediately, threatening to disrupt production further in the world's 8th largest oil exporter. 2 security sources in the oil industry said more than 100 people may have been killed by the fighting, which has spread to at least 7 villages in Rivers State.
In a report to the United Nations today, South Africa's Archbishop Desmond Tutu said Israel's deadly shelling in the Gaza Strip in November 2006 may constitute a war crime. The Nobel Peace Prize winner said in the report to the UN Human Rights Council, quote, in the absence of a well-founded explanation from the Israeli military, who is in sole possession of the relevant facts, the mission must include that there is a possibility that the shelling of Beit Hanun constituted a war crime. Tutu serves as an independent UN human rights envoy. He said Israel must be held accountable for its strike that hit two homes in the Gaza town of Beit Hanun, killing 18 people. Tutu said there should be an independent, impartial, and transparent investigation of the refugee town attack that took place in 2006. The Israeli military conducted its own investigation and called the injury of Palestinian civilians unintentional. It said the deaths and injuries were due to a technical failure and that no action was taken against military personnel because they bore no legal blame for the incident.
You're listening to the KPFA Evening News on 94.1 FM or online at kpfa.org. This hour-long newscast is broadcast each evening at 6. Coming up, Burmese exiles trying to unseat the ruling military junta at the United Nations, and a lawsuit to overturn Humboldt County's limits on corporate spending in elections. With John Hamilton, I'm Mark Miracle. Barack Obama today mocked John McCain's promise to bring change to Washington, saying the Republican presidential nominee has marched loyally with President Bush and was out of touch with the economic distress of struggling Americans. In 19 months, he has not named one thing he would do differently from this administration on the central issue of this election, Obama said of McCain, not one thing. And we know that if we go down that path, that the next 4 years will look exactly like the last 8. 7 weeks before the election, Obama sought to portray McCain as an unshakable ally of the unpopular Bush and Washington lobbyists, unsympathetic to the pocketbook issues that are the number one concern of American voters. Obama delivered a frontal attack that showed none of the hesitancy that has worried some of his own supporters as McCain edged ahead in the polls. Can you afford to take a chance on someone who's voted against the minimum wage 19 times? Obama asked a crowd of thousands under a blazing sun at a rally in western Colorado at the start of a swing through contested western states. When it was $4, he was against it. When it was $5, he was against it. When it was $6, he was against it, Obama said. Charging that McCain was out of touch, Obama said, he doesn't get what's happening between the mountains in Sedona, where he lives, and the corridors of power where he works. Why else would he say that we've made great progress economically under George Bush? Why else would he say that the economy isn't something he understands as well as he should? Why else would he say today of all days, just a few hours ago, think about this, we just woke up to the news of financial disaster, and this morning he said that the fundamentals of the economy are still strong. Senator McCain, Obama asked, what economy are you talking about?
A campaign spokesperson says Alaska Governor Sarah Palin won't speak with an investigator hired by lawmakers to look into the firing of her public safety commissioner. McCain campaign spokesperson Ed O'Callaghan told a news conference today that the governor, the Republican nominee for vice president, will not cooperate as long as the investigation remains tainted. He said he doesn't know whether Palin's husband would challenge a subpoena issued to compel his cooperation. The campaign insists the investigation has been hijacked by Democrats. It says it can prove Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan was fired because of insubordination on budget issues, not because he refused to fire a state trooper who had divorced Palin's sister.
After 2 years on the books, attorneys for the Pacific Legal Foundation were in court today challenging a ballot initiative passed by Humboldt County voters as unconstitutional and a violation of a corporation's free speech rights. They're seeking an injunction to place the measure on hold until a court rules on its merits. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the 19th century that corporations are considered persons and therefore are entitled to the same rights. The organization Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, joined by the Humboldt Coalition for Community Rights, argue that corporations are not persons, and they say the initiative is constitutional by the fact that voters adopted it through legal means. Wendell Harper has a story.
All the legal, political commotion in Humboldt County is about Measure T, passed by the voters in June 2006. From the perspective of sponsors, the need for such a measure came about when the county's district attorney was the subject of a recall.
Hello, my name is Paul Gallegos, your district attorney. Just 3 months after I was voted into office, Texas-based Maxam Corporation tried to have me recalled, undermining the decision made by Humboldt County voters. Democracy only works when the power resides in the people. I'm urging you to vote yes on Measure T for local control of our elections.
And just what exactly is Measure T? Caitlin Saposi Belknap, one of the sponsors of the measure, organizers of the campaign to place it on the June 2006 Humboldt County ballot.
Measure T is a ballot initiative that we passed in Humboldt County in 2006 that bans non-local corporations from contributing money to local elections.
And the Pacific Legal Foundation's challenge is basically what is, you know?
They're asserting that our law violates the constitutional rights of these non-local corporations and that it's unconstitutional.
The challenge may have come 2 years late because a precedent or statute needed to be uncovered that would meet the test of challenging the county's right to ban corporations which aren't situated in Humboldt County from making financial contributions to local elections. Measure T perhaps being challenged because the Pacific Legal Foundation, according to the sponsors, includes a direct challenge to what they call corporate personhood, the legal doctrine that allows corporations to claim constitutional rights such as the First Amendment. In a documentary entitled Corporations, a Person, this excerpt suggests how the idea came about.
You start with a group of people who want to invest their money in a company. Then these people apply for a charter as a corporation. This government issues a charter to that corporation. Now that corporation operates legally as an individual person. It is not a group of people. It is, under the law, a legal person.
These corporations argue that the First Amendment gives them the right to give political contributions. But before this, corporations took advantage of the 14th Amendment, according to Law and Democracy Representative Mary Zepnik, author Howard Zinn.
The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War, and therefore it said no state can deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And what happens is the corporations come into and they say, oh, you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property. A corporation is a person. And the Supreme Court goes along with that.
The 14th Amendment was passed to protect newly freed slaves. So, for instance, between 1890 and 1910, there were 307 cases brought before the court under the 14th Amendment. 288 of these brought by corporations, 19 by African Americans.
The Pacific Legal Foundation's argument that the ordinance restricts the ability of corporations to make contributions or expenditures pertaining to local elections. Specifically, the foundation contends the measure forbids all non-local corporations from making any contribution or expenditure in favor of or against any person running for local office or any referendum, initiative, or recall. But Saposi Belknap says that's exactly the point. Local control for local elections.
Our argument is that a corporation is not a person, and in fact, if you give corporations constitutional rights, it allows them to do things like overturn laws that people pass and communities pass to protect themselves against corporate power. And that was why we passed Measure T, because corporations have shown an undue influence in our election in the past. Our two most expensive campaigns in the history of our county were entirely financed by corporations on one side of them, spending over $250,000 a piece. One was Walmart and the other was Maxam Corporation in a recall attempt of our district attorney. And what we did through Measure T was said we're not going to allow that anymore.
One argument that perhaps will be used at some point, just what is the difference between an individual and a corporation? We get a pro and con from a documentary narrator, an MIT's Noam Chomsky, Royal Dutch Shell's Sir Mark Moody Stewart.
Even someone living under a banyan tree is dependent on support from someone. Economic lag has to be addressed by everyone. It's not just a business issue.
But unlike someone under a banyan tree, the publicly traded corporation has been structured by a series of legal decisions. It is required by law to place the financial interests of its owners above competing interests.
Close to half the stock is owned by about 1% of the population, and the bottom 80% of the population hold about 4% of the stock.
Today's hearing seeks an injunction. Other hearings are to be held. Pacific Catholic Legal Foundation is challenging Measure T as a violation of the First Amendment's protections for political speech and a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. But the measure restricts corporations which aren't actually situated in Humboldt County from contributing to local elections. It does not prevent local corporations from doing so.
Our community has a right to define who can participate in elections, and we do not want outside corporations trying to influence us through the ballot box.
Reporting for KPFA News, this is Wendell Harper.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said late today he will not sign the compromise budget proposal that California lawmakers are considering tonight unless they include his request for a stronger savings account. In a letter to the four legislative leaders, the governor says he wants more money set aside in a rainy day fund and tighter controls on when that money could be spent. The letter was obtained by the Associated Press as the state assembly was meeting to consider a proposal to end the state's record-long budget impasse. The governor has been stumping statewide for long-term fiscal reform and had said he will not sign a budget that fails to include it. He wants 3% of general fund revenue to be automatically deposited into the rainy day account each year, stopping only when that account reaches 12.5% of the general fund. Schwarzenegger also wants assurances that the fund could be tapped only when revenue falls below projected spending.
The Los Angeles coroner's office says the death toll in the Chatsworth commuter train crash has reached 26 with the death of a man in a hospital. Coroner's assistant chief Ed Winter says the death was reported to his office today. The man died Saturday at County USC Medical Center. The commuter train carrying 220 people rolled past stop signals Friday and barreled head-on into a Union Pacific freight train. The accident injured 138 people. Senator Barbara Boxer wants the Senate Commerce Committee to hold an emergency hearing on the commuter rail collision. The California Democrat made the request in a letter today to the chair and top Republican of the committee, on which she's a member. Boxer wants senators to discuss legislation requiring technology that would prevent crashes even when a train fails to stop at a red light, as happened in Friday's crash.
Burmese in exile are challenging the legitimacy of the ruling military junta at the 63rd session of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. With 45 years of rule by various military leaders, Burma is the oldest dictatorship in the world, and it's one of the world's poorest countries, despite its rich oil and natural gas deposits. An alternative delegation of the National Coalition Government of the Union of Burma, or NCGUB, has filed a petition with the UN Credentials Committee demanding that it be seated at the UN in place of the junta. Ari Paul reports from the UN.
When the Burmese National League for Democracy won 80% of the country's vote in 1990, the ruling military junta took quick action. It arrested its leaders and outlawed attempts to convene a new parliament. Many parliamentarians live in exile, and the democracy movement's iconic leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, is currently living under house arrest. 18 years later, the elected government is making the case to the United Nations that it should represent the country rather than its current military rulers. The New York-based National Coalition Government of the Union of Burma announced its formal credentials challenge on September 9th at the UN's Credentials Committee. Paul Williams is one of the attorneys for the NCGUB and says several governments have used such a challenge at the UN successfully since 1950.
It's not enough to unseat a government because of oppression, human rights violations, or the simple fact you don't like the way that they're governing. The seats at the General Assembly are reserved for elected governments. You have a democratically elected government which has been pushed out, and that's their legitimate claim. You don't have that many of those situations out there. And where you have the Hungarians in 1956, the Sierra Leone government, the Cambodian government, they have been able to effectively, over a number of years, and with great political and legal effort, they have been able to effectively reclaim their seats.
UN member states witnessed examples of the junta's wrath last year, the exile group says. Last September, the government violently put down a peaceful demonstration by monks and in March refused international assistance after Cyclone Nargis hit the country. And as a result of one of the largest mass exoduses in recent history, 2 million Burmese live in camps in Thailand, India, and Malaysia. Meanwhile, under international pressure, the Burmese junta announced new elections set for 2010, but the coalition calls them a sham. Maung Maung is the NCGUB's general secretary.
For example, somebody who is married to a non-Burmese cannot run for election, or somebody who has not had any experience or 5 years in the military cannot run for presidency. So these are the kind of restrictions that are imposed within the Constitution itself, and this is what we don't agree.
The Credentials Committee includes the United States, China, and Russia, and it will make a recommendation on the credentials challenge after the General Assembly session begins September 16th. It will then be put to the whole Assembly for a vote. The NCGUB hopes that the challenge will give the UN the chance to review and publicize the lack of real elections and the junta's human rights record. Steve Crawshaw is the UN Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. He says that despite support for Burma from several Western representatives and a special envoy to the country, the UN has to do more to pressure the junta into making major reforms.
And it could have threatened sanctions. To be honest, even condemnation would be a step forward.
Despite Free Speech Radio News' numerous requests sent to Burma's UN mission, the country's officials were not available to comment on the credentials challenge. And the Burmese leaders in exile think it might take several years of petitioning and campaigning at the UN. Russia and China may remain silent over the credential petition or even support the military junta. And if the petition is denied this time, the exiled leaders say they would be back at the UN next year. At the United Nations in New York, this is Ari Paul for FSRN.
Mexican police and soldiers quelled a six-hour riot by inmates protesting alleged abuse by guards at a state penitentiary in the border city of Tijuana. A firefighter says at least 40 people were injured in the violence, seven with bullet wounds, and about 60% of La Mesa prison in Tijuana was burned in the melee. Baja California's public safety secretary says the riot started late yesterday while guards were searching cells for drugs and arms. Several messages hung by inmates during the riot claimed prison guards had killed at least two inmates, beating one man to death on Saturday and killing the other last week. The banner read, "No more dead, the guards are assassins." Mariana Martinez reports from Tijuana.
The riot began during visiting hours yesterday when 5,000 inmates took over the prison by taking guards hostage. Over 500 visitors, mainly women and children, remained inside the prison even after authorities used several rounds of tear gas. The riot comes just a day after a 19-year-old inmate was killed. Fellow cooks at the prison and family members say Israel Blanco Marquez was brutally tortured by prison guards. Prison officials claim the inmate died of a concussion when a TV set fell on his head. Families complained about guards who demand bribes in exchange for visitation rights and safety from punishment and brutal beatings. Overcrowding at the Tijuana jail is one of the worst in the Mexican prison system, where they experience sanitation problems and lack of medical care. At least 26 inmates are housed in cells designed for 9 people. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mariana Martinez from Tijuana, Mexico.
A series of actions against Shell Oil in Ireland and Britain today. Activists are trying to stop construction of a natural gas pipeline on the west coast of Ireland. Maeve Conran reports.
Protesters targeted Shell Oil's office in Dublin as well as the London offices of Allseas, the owners of the world's largest pipeline vessel. The ship arrived on the west coast of Ireland last week to lay pipes for Shell Oil's natural gas project. A local school principal has been on hunger strike since the ship's arrival, and a local fisherman was arrested for blocking the ship. For 4 years, environmental groups and concerned residents have protested the project, which includes an onshore refinery and miles of pipeline. The project is spearheaded by Shell Oil and includes Norwegian Statoil and Marathon Oil from Texas. In 2005, a number of local people were jailed for 3 months for refusing to allow construction of the pipeline on their land. Since 2006, €11 million has been spent policing the project. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran.
Elliot Hughes is one of hundreds of activists arrested during the Republican National Convention in St. Paul earlier this month. Hughes charges sheriff deputies subjected him to torture. Ora Bagato reports.
19-year-old Hughes says that after being arrested and sent to the Ramsey County Jail, he was knocked unconscious by police officers who then dragged him into a separate detention cell where they hooded him and then beat him severely. Elliot Hughes.
They put a bag over my head that had a gag on it, and they used pain compliance tactics on me for about an hour and a half. They separated my jaw as hard as they could with their fingers, and they bent my ankles back. They basically bent my foot backwards. I was screaming for God and screaming for mercy, crying, asking them why they were doing this. I've never been so violated in my life. I was extremely traumatized. Shortly after that, they took me to the hospital and gave me stitches, and I was refused to speak with a social worker.
Local Sheriff Bob Fletcher says that Hughes was disruptive in jail and officers used force to subdue him. Hughes is now considering a lawsuit against Ramsey County for his treatment.
That's Ora Bogato reporting. Affordable housing activists in New York are trying to stop a luxury private development on public land. Zoe Sullivan reports from New York.
Roughly 120 people came out to demand affordable housing in Queens yesterday. The Hunters Point South area is public land that is slated for luxury development. Many at the rally carried signs reading, "Public land for public use." The mayor's plan would create market-rate housing for people earning from $60,000 to $160,000 a year. The median income in Queens is just over $51,000 a year, according to NYU's Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Planning. Additionally, the center reports that the median monthly rent in Queens has risen 80% since 1990. Queens for Affordable Housing, a coalition of community, religious, and policy groups, is demanding that the city require developers to make half of the new units affordable to Queens residents earning less than $60,000 a year. HUD estimates that 12 million households, both renters and homeowners, currently pay more than 50% of their annual income on housing. The City Planning Commission will make recommendations about the project on September 24th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Zoe Sullivan in New York.
A federal judge has thrown out plans to allow more than 500 snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park this winter. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan made the decision today. The National Park Service had planned to license 540 snowmobiles and 83 snow coaches to go through Yellowstone every day beginning this winter. For the last three winters, approximately 250 snowmobiles per day used the park's trails, according to environmentalists and park advocates. But Sullivan called the National Park Service decision to license more snowmobiles per day contrary to law, and said the Park Service hasn't explained why the plan is necessary. The judge said the National Park Service must redo the plan.
Tomorrow on KPFA's morning program, a full hour's look at the economic situation in the United States, mayhem on Wall Street and every street from 7 to 8, with economist James K. Galbraith and Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning in the San Francisco Bay Area, then becoming partly cloudy, highs in the upper 50s to the lower 70s around the bay. In the East Bay interior valleys, morning low clouds, then becoming sunny, highs in the mid-70s to the mid-80s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, tomorrow mostly sunny with highs from 90 to 98 degrees. That's it for the news tonight on this Monday, September 15th. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Rose Katabshi, who produced the recorded portions of this broadcast. She is also at the controls. With John Hamilton, I'm Mark Miracle. Good evening.
Of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending September 28th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. On Thursday, September 25th at 8 p.m., Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts presents Roy Brown along with Latin Grammy nominee Walter Morciglio. Roy's albums have become classics of the independence movement in Puerto Rico. This event is $20 and is located at 2868 Mission Street in San Francisco. For details, visit missionculturalcenter.org or call 415-821-1155. This year, Shul of Marin celebrates children and elders during high holiday services. During Rosh Hashanah, there will be a vegetarian potluck feast on September 22nd at sunset. This free event is located at the Community Congregational Church at 145 Rock Hill Drive in Tiburon. For details, call 415-419-3511.
The House of Amun-Ra presents a fall annual jazz and arts festival as a series of cultural events connected with the Oakland-based Pan-African spiritual movement. The festival will take place on Saturday, September 27th from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Mills College campus, Rothwell Center, Building 29 at 5000 MacArthur Boulevard in Oakland. Tickets are $10. For details, call 510-654-2620. This community calendar was produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listings at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Fax them to 5-